This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. A year ago, most Americans would have been skeptical of the idea that white supremacist hate groups like the KKK would become the subjects of national dialogue. Yet here we are today, within the first year of Donald Trump's administration, and a sense of despair about the nation's future has sunk in as hate groups get nods from the president and the corporate oligarchy is dismantling regulations and pillaging resources. Framing the political conversation around the health of our democracy is critical to understanding what ails the U.S. and how to fix it. That framing can spur social movements to regain control of the narrative and begin resisting the multi-pronged assault of Trumpism in a more effective way. Joining me to discuss all of this is Henry A. Giroux. He is the McMaster University Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest and the Paulo Freire Distinguished Scholar in Critical Pedagogy. His most recent books include The Violence of Organized Forgetting, Dangerous Thinking in the Age of the New Authoritarianism, America at War with Itself, and co-authored with Brad Evans, Disposable Futures, The Seduction of Violence in the Age of Spectacle. His newest book is called The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism. Welcome to the program, Professor Giroux.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
So it's tempting to consider that the Trump administration is so inept that it will sort of fold in on itself. Many of us, as we watched the first month or two unfold, hoped that the sheer ineptness would lead to the Trump administration falling apart on its own and us then being able to move on. That has not happened, even though there's one controversy after another. Do you feel that this administration is still as strong as it is dangerous and still needs a very persistent resistance?
No, I mean, I think it's enormously dangerous. I mean, it controls, it controls both houses of Congress, controls the Supreme Court, and basically you have a president who acts like an impetuous four-year-old. So I think that when we talk about checks and balances, what becomes clear is not that Trump is simply inept. What becomes clear that we live in a society in which democracy has almost entirely died, that the checks and balances that were put into place to in some way be able to contain somebody like Trump are no longer operative. I mean, this is a politics governed by money, governed by the economy, governed by a neoliberal logic. And it's one that is, as I've said repeatedly in a number of books, is not only authoritarian in the worst sense, but is enormously dangerous both for the planet and for the rest of the world.
So there is no sort of opposing force within the Republican Party that's going to look at Trump as just too much of a liability and back off?
No, I think that clearly we know there are contradictions within the party. We know that he's been attacking Mitch McConnell, and he attacks basically anybody who doesn't agree with him or disagrees with him in the most moderate sense. But I think that you want to understand what the limits of that disagreement might be. I mean, these are not people fighting over whether or not capitalism works. You know, these are not people who are fighting over the rule of finance capital. These are not people who are fighting over whether or not there's a correlation between democracy and the racial state. I mean, these are people who are extremists who have come into power, and the kind of the problem that is basically taking place under the Trump administration is that he's not finesseful. I mean, he shoots from the hip. And so what he does is he exposes an ideology that in the past has been sort of glided over, encoded over in the language of racism, in the language of welfare, the attack on the welfare system, the attack on workers. But Trump basically doesn't care about that. Trump will say anything that he wants. And so increasingly what you have is you have a number of Republicans within the party who are being exposed in that the extremism that they adhere to and support under Trump is now enormously visible. Now, whether or not they act on that in a fundamental way to sort of prevent the worst kind of legislative policies from being implemented is another question. That's conceivable. That may happen. But, over impeaching Trump, preventing him from implementing policies, I don't think so. I think we're stuck with Trump for four more years. And I think at the same time, there'll be an enormous amount of resistance to Trump, and we see it. It's happening among young people. It's happening among people who no longer will have health insurance. It's happening among people who all of a sudden find that at the level of daily life, they can't survive. it's happening among people who recognize that this guy is a serial liar. Not all, but some. And the real question here is, how do we tap into a pedagogical modes of intervention that can organize people in a way to recognize that all the reasons that Trump gave for their despair are basically false, that the real reason for their despair is the enormous presence of a financial elite that basically transfers wealth from the public to the private realm, and in doing so has created a society marked by enormous gaps in inequality, wealth, and power.
So the attacks are multi-pronged, right? We identify this, we see this, many social movements are involved, but I think one of the things that you point out in your book that's really important is that we're not all necessarily on the same page. So you've got groups like Black Lives Matter fighting police brutality far before Trump. You've got unions that are fighting for labor rights. You've got unions also fighting for things like healthcare reform. You've got women's groups fighting, but are we all coordinated enough to meet the challenge of Trumpism, not just Trump, but Trumpism?
No, I think that's an important, it may be the most important political question that can be asked at this moment in history. I mean, the real issue is the left going to allow itself to be fractured around single issue movements, or is it going to find a way to both advocate for those movements while at the same time going beyond them and creating a larger social movement in which those various movements can be integrated under the concern for developing what we might call a radical democracy or a radical democratic socialist society. I mean, we're really talking about, in the best of all worlds, we're talking about bringing these groups together rather than simply allowing them to exist in a way that undercuts their power by virtue of their being so limited in terms of the issues that they speak to. And this is not an argument against the issues that they speak to. Racism matters, inequality matters. But I think what really matters is how do we bring these groups together in a way in which the power that they're capable of mobilizing cuts across these divisions in ways that allow real powerful political and social formations to begin to develop.
So let's talk about trying to frame the attacks from the Republican Party, and to a lesser extent, even the Democratic Party, within the idea of democracy. Democracy is something that can and should, of course, unite us all. But how do we frame the capitalist onslaught on workers' rights within the framework of democracy? Voting rights is a much clearer link, but then, you know, you have things like police brutality. Should democracy be that overarching framework? And if so, how do we make those links?
Well, I think the first thing that we do is we refuse to equate capitalism and democracy. I mean, I think capitalism and democracy are not only not the same thing, I would argue that capitalism is the antithesis of democracy.
And do both parties do that? Do both parties equate capitalism with democracy?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that both of them would claim that basically they're operating within a democratic manifesto in which, you know, everything floats to the bottom, or that wealth really is being in some way distributed fairly, or that the militarization that we see in society functions in the best interest of everybody. I mean, you know, they have a moral compass. I mean, it's not like they're saying, you know, nothing matters except our own interest. They have to sort of dress that up and legitimate it, although I think that it becomes increasingly difficult to do that. But at the same time, as I've written recently, we see a movement emerging all over Europe called the liberal democracy, and in which actually Trump is an advocate, it seems to me, in which there are more and more people saying that democracy is flawed. It doesn't work. You know, we need to get rid of it. It's not operative anymore. And we see this, of course, in a whole range of places, particularly in Hungary and in Poland, where people are saying, look, the future does not reside in liberal democracy. It resides in illiberal democracy. We have to combine elements of authoritarianism with elements of power in ways to make sure that we maximize the economic structures for the limited few as much as we can.
So when we talk about this framing of democracy as this overarching structure, do you see the left being able to coalesce around it? Because it so often feels as though the left is its own worst enemy, right? We do have a lot of fracturing of groups. A big part of it comes from groups that are working around issues important to people of color, feeling like white liberals don't listen enough to their issues or take it seriously enough their issues. Black Lives Matter showed over the past year and a half that you do have to pay attention to things like police brutality, systemic racism, etc.
I mean, the real issue is not whether you pay attention to them. The real issue is, how do you connect them? And I think that's the key. I mean, I think, how do we connect police brutality with the school to prison pipeline? How do we do that? You know, how do we connect massive inequalities in wealth and power with a growing incarceration state? You know, how do we connect the war on women and particularly reproductive rights with a notion of patriarchy that's absolutely endemic to what I would call neoliberal ideology? So I think the real key here is, you know, how do you bring these forces together in ways that present a larger issue that allows people to understand how one influences the other? Now, that's the first issue. I mean, the other issue, which you haven't mentioned, which is implicit in your question, is, what role does education play in this, in politics?
Right.
I mean, how do we get beyond the assumption that domination is only about economic structures and not about subjectivity and not about consciousness and not about ideas and not about ideologies? I mean, I'm terribly sick of hearing a left seem to suggest that all you have to do is point to economic structures and how they work, and people will somehow be liberated. Actually, what you really need to do is to create a language pedagogically in which people can recognize themselves and the problems that they're enduring, so that in some way they don't translate private, so they're able to translate private issues into larger public considerations. I mean, remember, the key to domination in the United States, for the most part, it seems to me, is what I would call the privatization of the self. You know, the privatization of the self, meaning that people are led to believe that all problems are due to individual issues that they're responsible for, that there are no larger social issues, that those issues, if I'm poor, it's because I don't try hard enough. You know, if I'm homeless, it's because, I really don't take myself too seriously. It goes on and on. And I think this inability to translate individual issues into larger structural, economic, and ideological concerns is really at the heart of a neoliberal pedagogy that's enormously successful in depoliticizing people.
And in fact, on that, I think it's really important for us to recognize how successful the right has been with equating capitalism with democracy. And, you know, you hear a lot of the white nationalist groups making this, a case that just with, you know, using a dismissive language like you're a communist or socialist, a Cold War style language, which somehow still manages to irk enough people and get enough of people on their side that they can become effective against the left, or at least in their language, they can become effective against the left, even if they themselves personally are suffering from capitalist pillaging of their resources. That's just an amazing thing that they've managed to accomplish using this language of capitalism and personal responsibility.
No, I you're absolutely right. I think the greatest failure of the left is to precisely identify what you have just articulated, the inability of the left to basically create a theoretical and pedagogical framework and an educational landscape in which people can begin to understand and connect various issues so as to not blame themselves for the problems in which they find themselves suffering from. I mean, this is absolutely crucial, because look, in the first instance, what is politics? Politics is the struggle over agency, right? It's a struggle over agency. I mean, who's going to control your agency? I mean, who's going to define your relationship to yourself and others in the larger world? What ideological architectures are at work out there that are limiting your ability to really understand that the language that you're given is the language of oppression? You know, it's the language that basically internalizes oppression. This Paulo Freire talked about this for years. Raymond Williams talked about this. Gramsci talked about this. Rosa Luxemburg talked about this. I mean, these were Marxists who understood that you cannot talk about liberation, you cannot talk about emancipation without recognizing that politics, in the first and foremost instance, is an educational issue. It's an educational issue. You know, if people's consciousness can't be raised, and if they can't understand the connections between themselves and the larger forces that are oppressing them, we're done. You know, they basically will feel isolated. They'll feel alone. They'll join a sense of community in which they're looking for people to rescue them. I mean, it's a script for fascism. You know, people basically don't have a language, and all of a sudden find themselves utterly isolated. And in a sense, in that isolation, are looking for symbolic forms of community in which they can have, in some way, develop a sense of who they are. There's no politics without identification. And it seems to me that when the right offers the only forms of identification that seem to be working, then we know that the left has failed.
So how do you, Professor Henry Giroux, how do you make the connection to somebody who looks at white supremacist forces rising and having, you know, these so-called free speech rallies, getting nods from the president, and say to them that this is rooted within the larger assault on democracy? How do you make that case if you had the chance to sit down with an organizer who's concerned about healthcare reform, for example?
Well, I think there are a number of things that can be done. I mean, first of all, historical consciousness has always been the enemy of fascism, right? I mean, the last thing that we want people to do is to look into the past and be able to see examples of situations in which forms of domination were not only exposed, but alternative modes of liberation were made obvious. Alternative modes of the welfare state, for instance, were made obvious. And I think that, you know, one of the things that it seems to me that the left has to do is it has to be able to situate this white nationalism, this white supremacy, you know, in a context, historical context, in which people can see what its consequences are. I mean, when I see young people, you know, in Charlottesville carrying signs with a swastika on them, I mean, I'm an older generation. I'm Chomsky and I are from the same generation. We know what that symbol means. I mean, it means that millions of people, intellectuals, gays, Jews, were killed, literally killed. And I think to identify with this murderous death machine and not have an understanding of what you're actually doing represents an enormous failure in the civic, it seems to me, attributes of a culture. This is a culture that basically has failed civically, in that it now, rather than producing civic literacy, it produces civic illiteracy. And people can't make the connections and tend to see this, I don't know, as a symbol of community rather than as a symbol of hatred. I think the other side of this is that we have to find ways in which education can be used both in and out of schools to bring people together to be able to address their issues in ways in which we don't believe that education is only about schooling. I mean, the media matters. I mean, for the first time in our history, we have a media that actually has some spaces where people can get published, where people can speak. This program, for instance, you know. So it seems to me that we have to broaden those spaces in ways that allow people to amplify their sense and their relationship to not only themselves and to others, but also the world. And it seems to me that's the route we have to take. I mean, if we can't educate people, if we can't change their consciousness, trust me, you know, in 10, 15 years, you know, you're going to be living in a place that doesn't look unlike something we saw in the 1930s and 40s in Nazi Germany.
The language of democracy, of course, is so crucial. And I think that's one where the left could make so much more headway, right? I mean, if we frame our ideas in terms of what, you know, what the majority of Americans might want that link up with a common good, we might have a better chance of pushing these things forward. And I'm wondering if you think somebody like Bernie Sanders was able to come closest to doing that as any political figure of a high profile has in a long time.
No, I think that Bernie Sanders did a wonderful thing, and that what he did was he elevated and expanded the nature of the conversation, as you're suggesting. All of a sudden, we're talking about inequality. All of a sudden, we're talking about ruling classes. All of a sudden, we're talking about the concentration of power and what these things do to a democracy. They basically undermine them and destroy them. And I think that matters. I also think that we need to talk in terms of our responsibility to future generations. I mean, democracy is not just about the rights that we have. Democracy is also about the rights that we want to hand down to our children. And I don't think we talk enough about young people in terms of what the possibilities are for a future that is not going to be ruled by people like Trump. And I, you know, you hear about race, you hear about gender, you hear about class, and they're important and crucial. But isn't it odd that you rarely ever hear anything about young people? You know, you rarely ever hear about the expanding prison population of young people. You rarely hear much about how schools have become increasingly militarized, that there are very few of us who are sort of making this connection. And yet I would argue that the most important moral obligation a generation has in order to be able to in some way examine and analyze its own politics is to be able to look at the kind of society that's being created for its young people. That's a crucial issue.
So finally, Professor Giroux, then in terms of us reclaiming the language of democracy, reframing the problems of capitalism and coordinating our efforts, another pitfall that the left often ends up in is hitching its success to the Democratic Party, because that's the oppositional party to the Republicans, even though, of course, the Democratic Party is in bed with Wall Street. And the conversations around Bernie Sanders and whether he should have run an independent campaign versus go with the Democratic Party reflected some of that. There's now a petition by thousands of people who want him to start their own party. Can using electoral politics as a vehicle for change, first and foremost, end up hampering our movements?
I don't think the issue is should be narrowed to simply questions of electoral reform. If I'm reading your question correctly, then tell me if I'm not, okay? What I hear you saying and what I agree with is that electoral reform is not the way to go towards restructuring the system and getting it and taking it away from the hands of neoliberal capitalists. That's not going to work. I mean, it seems to me that the Democratic Party is really the party of the financial elite. It's just a softer version. I mean, we really need to think in terms of an entirely different party representing entirely different issues. And I think to go back to the question you had raised earlier, I think that where Sanders really failed was that, you know, he mobilized all these young people and all of a sudden had injected a very different kind of radical discourse into the campaign. And all of a sudden he's supporting the Democratic Party that then attacks him and does everything it can to make sure that he doesn't get the nomination. I mean, you know, that's not the way it's going to work if we're going to talk about democracy and we're going to talk about new political and political and social formations that in the long run, you know, can be able to mobilize people to address very different issues under the banner of a very different political party. I mean, you know, it's interesting because there was a piece recently, I read it last night somewhere, in which this young man is talking about how, well, you know, there's really very little hope. I don't see how this is going to change and blah, blah, blah. And it goes on and on, you know, and I thought to myself, you know, this is really a script for a dystopian society, because it seems to me that when you give up hope, when you believe that there's no possibility for change, when you believe that power is only about domination and nothing else, then you've joined the ranks of the oppressors. I mean, the real issue here is not to sort of engage in utopian dreams that have no bearing on reality. The real issue here is to say, hey, look, history is not closed. It's open. And we need to think very carefully about what the possibilities are for creating a very different society under very different terms. And that's not going to happen in one day. It takes time for these things to happen. I think we need to think not just simply in terms of the short term, we need to think also in terms of the long term.
What, in your mind, are the most effective social movements that you can identify today that come closest to, you know, having this hopeful and yet effective resistance, trying to use the framing of strengthening our democracy that you feel can be on the front lines of the resistance to Trumpism?
I mean, I like what the Black Lives Matter movement is doing. I like it because it's constantly evolving and growing. And that, to me, is a very promising sign, meaning that it's reaching across borders and looking at oppressed groups in other countries and sort of engaging in a conversation with them about the tactics, about the strategies that they're using. It also sees the oppression of capitalism basically in international terms and not just simply in national terms. And I think that's enormously useful. I think the other side of this is that it's got to find a way now to reach out and to bring people into this movement under a very different kind of label that basically talks about a politic that is more totalizing, more comprehensive. You know, we need a more comprehensive politics, one that integrates questions of ecology and ecological justice with overturning the prison state and addressing it in some way. Inequality and power and a whole range of issues that they have to be related. These issues have to be brought together. And I think if we can do that and we can create educational apparatuses that constantly make that claim by speaking to those issues, I think that there's real hope for the left.
And in fact, the platform of the Movement for Black Lives is quite a comprehensive document, which I don't think has gotten enough exposure.
No, I agree. Yeah. I think it's actually the most comprehensive document I've seen.
Wow. Well, Henry Giroux, thank you so much for joining us today and spending this time with us.
You bet.
I've been speaking with Henry A. Giroux, the McMaster University Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest and the Paulo Freire Distinguished Scholar in Critical Pedagogy. He's written a number of books, and we've just been discussing his latest work, The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.